Hello, and welcome once again to the Community Bookshelf. I'm Mary Richards, and I'm reading The Horizontal World, Growing Up Wild in the Middle of Nowhere, by Deborah Marquardt, published by Counterpoint, a member of the Perseus Books Group, New York, in 2006. We rejoin our reading at the very end of the prologue, as Deborah is going off to school in Bismarck, North Dakota. She is describing the cottonwood trees, grown huge, that ringed their farmyard. I had nightmares that the thick trunks would come down in the heavy wind, that they would fall the entire length of our big backyard, break through the roof, and crush me in my bed. I did not understand, then, about the deep tangle of roots underneath that holds things up, that holds things in place. The day before I left home for college, I took a photograph of the road leading out of my parents' farm, the long driveway stretching out to the open wheat fields and the giant tops of the cottonwoods reaching up to the sky. The photograph must have been taken in late afternoon. The shadows are long. The light is cast in gold and bronze, the sweet color of memory. The picture of home was one undeveloped frame in my camera, the first in a succession of images I planned to collect of more interesting places. I got myself on that road, and I did not wave back. I concentrated only on flight. And for a long time, it seemed to me, North Dakota looked best only when glanced at briefly while adjusting the rearview mirror. Chapter 1. Things Not Seen in a Rearview Mirror. On the morning of my father's funeral in 1996, a house on the road blocked for a time all flow of traffic on Highway 3, the two-lane blacktop in central North Dakota that stretches south of I-94 to my hometown. I spotted the house first as a sliver of roof and eaves, weaving like an apparition on the horizon where the road should have been. "Is that a house?" I asked my husband, who knows best to drive and remain quiet the closer we get to ground zero. We had driven 600 miles the day before and collapsed into bed at a hotel in Jamestown, an hour away. Highway 3 runs parallel to, and only a few miles shy of, the 100th meridian. This north-south line of demarcation, described by Wallace Stegner in Beyond the 100th Meridian as an inflexible line of aridity, is generally considered to mark the end of the Midwest and the beginning of the West. Beyond this point, precipitation drops to between 8 and 16 inches annually, and Stegner notes that 20 inches of precipitation a year is the minimum needed for unaided agriculture. Another 40 miles west of here, the Missouri River crooks south on its way to joining the Mississippi and eventually the Gulf of Mexico. In the end, water returns to water, leaving behind sagebrush, tumbleweed. As early as the 1820s, Major Stephen Long's expedition to the Rocky Mountains deemed this part of the country inhospitable for life. His chronicler, Edwin James, cautioned that this region should forever remain the unmolested haunt of the native hunter, the bison, and the jackal. Here is the uncharted world into which Lewis and Clark took their famous voyage north and west 200 years ago. Passing through this part of Dakota Territory on October 19, 1804, Captain Meriwether Lewis recorded in his journal seeing countless buffalo, elk, pelicans, white-tailed deer, and trumpeter swans. The expedition spotted herds of pronghorned antelope, which the explorers inaccurately identified as goats. In what is now North Dakota, they encountered their first grizzly bear. They saw abandoned Arikara encampments and the high, strong watchtowers of a ruined Mandan village, as well as stone monuments and remarkable natural formations. High, round hills that formed a core at the top where they spotted golden eagles nesting. On October 20, in this part of Dakota Territory, they encountered a pack of 10 wolves. They wounded a white bear and discovered the tracks of an animal whose paw print was 3 times larger than the foot of a man. Today, as you travel west through North Dakota on I-94 toward Montana, you'll notice that slopes get deeper and roads get lonelier. West of the Missouri, towns get smaller and farther in between. Precipitation diminishes. Population density decreases. Buildings look broken down, boarded up, and thirsty for paint. Whole towns consist of 2 bars, a post office, and a grain elevator. It's likely the only number on the rise in this part of the country is the percentage of guns and Bibles per capita. There's room to grow strange and idiosyncratic here. Room to spread out your power tools and abandon your rusted cars. But aside from the Get U.S. Out of the U.N. sign slathered in red paint on a sloping barn near Dawson, right next to the yellow Honey for Sale sign, you would not sense anything unusual while driving Highway 3. Just an endless succession of farms, fields, and fences. On the morning of my father's funeral, I kept waiting for the next curve or rise to correct my vision, expecting the growing roof of the house on the road to slither to the right or left and become simply one more farmhouse on the side of the road. I know the topography of this drive from every conceivable angle, could read it with my fingers like Braille. If you installed my memory like a slotted reel on a player piano, the ghostly keys would play out this tune. There is the gravel turnoff to Grandma and Grandpa Geist's old place. There's the farm where the doll triplets lived. There's the ruin of the old country store where the little boy was run over by a milk truck. This is the place of dust where I spent my childhood, the place that extracted from me the price of one childhood. On the morning of my father's funeral, as we came over the next rise, I saw we had 3 miles to go. This is Logan County. While it may be just another patch of flat horizon to someone driving through, to the people of my family, it's the navel of the earth, the place from which all things flow and to which all things return in time. A few miles up the highway is the hill where most of my family is buried. The Catholics, my father's side, in the graveyard east of the road, and my mother's family, the Lutherans, on the west side. My father would be buried on that hill later that morning, laid to rest within 1 mile of our farm, the place where he was born. This feels biblical to me, the full and eternal return. Like the myth about Adam at Golgotha, buried in the very place where he was conceived. Gravity seems to pull stronger in Logan County. I recall being conscious of it as a child, the grounding heaviness of the place. I imagined my life to be a held clock, a suspended pendulum that started ticking each time I laid my body down on the land. Whether to sleep or partake of the land's fruits, I knew I was binding myself to its earthly contracts. I tried to live lightly here, to move through this world as a slip or a shadow, to keep my appetites and desires to a minimum, lest I start the clock ticking in earnest. As soon as possible, I moved away from Logan County, and I have lived in places where gravity pulls less on me, mostly college towns in other states. But no matter how far I travel, no matter how magnificent my flight, I fear this place will become jealous of my wandering and claim me as its own. By equally weird logic, I believe that if I avoid Logan County, death will have more trouble locating me. Please, I beg my husband at times when I feel really desperate, if I ever get sick, no matter what happens to me, please don't send me home to die. I say this as a joke, so it doesn't sound demented. It's usually in the middle of the night when I can't sleep, and I'm usually crying when I say it. I have woken him up to tell him all the things I'm concerned about, and when I get to this part, don't send me home to die, we usually both start laughing. It sounds so ridiculous to our ears. But we laugh for different reasons. He laughs because he doesn't have a hillside in North America where all the bones of his ancestors are collected. And I laugh because no matter how far I wander, I know that hillside waits for me. In front of us that morning stretched the low-lying bowl of land that once belonged to my great-grandfather, Joseph Marquardt. He was born near the Black Sea in South Russia in 1856, 100 years before me, and he died a wealthy man in central North Dakota in 1937. The headline of his obituary described him as the Logan County Wheat King for a quarter century. This is big, to be king of wheat in a part of the country where wheat is king. In my own time, I was Dairy Princess of Logan County, a short-lived title I was stripped of when I refused to attend the state Dairy Princess competition and pit my creamy milkmaid thighs and flashing farmer's daughter eyes against those of beauties from across the state. How many times had I asked my father to recount for me the number of sections of land great-grandpa had owned? And he'd stare in the air to the right, the place where all his memories seemed to be stored, and he'd tick them off on his fingers. The north fields, the south fields, the slough land, the lake acres, the gravel pit, the quarters by the wildwoods. 9 full sections of land, 5,760 acres, not counting the lots he owned in town, the land in western North Dakota, and the land in Saskatchewan he bought during his salad days. In the early 1900s, within 15 years of my great-grandfather's arrival in America, he had managed to acquire almost 6,000 acres of land. How he accomplished this is unknown. When I've asked questions of some of the oldest people in town, I've been told that he was a good farmer, a shrewd horse trader, and that he had the immigrant's twin gift of enterprise and frugality. In the early days of gasoline tractors, he devised a small tank on wheels with a nozzle that allowed him to travel by horse and cart from farm to farm and sell fuel. This was a rumor in our family until my brother unearthed the very tank with wheels in the dump ground near the lake that borders our land. The water was high that year, and when it receded, the rusty belly emerged after decades of burial. In other popular stories, my great-grandfather was a rum runner during Prohibition, bringing alcohol across the border from Canada. He was also reputed to have owned shares in a Colorado gold mine. He purchased the shares, supposedly, when he received remuneration from the French government for iron ore mines that his own grandparents had owned in Alsace. This story, impossible to verify, was set aside as fabrication, until I learned that his nickname was Iron Joe, a vital clue, given that nicknames in my ethnic group are deep indicators of family traits. In the only picture I have of my great-grandfather, he's sitting on a wooden bench in front of an old storefront. The picture was taken in the 1930s, near the end of his life. He's wearing a trim black suit and a brimmed hat. The image is grainy and has been copied many times. It's hard to make out the features of his face because he's wearing glasses and has a thick mustache. His hat brim is pulled down over his face, making him look like someone in disguise. And perhaps he is. The story in our family is that Joseph removed the letter D from our last name, Marquardt, spelled M-A-R-Q-U-A-R-D-T, when he came through Ellis Island in order to confuse the Russian military, which had forcibly conscripted him in 1882, and from which he was on the run in 1885 when he immigrated to America. From the photo, it's possible to see his boldness even in old age. He's aimed his body into the lens. He's straightened his back and stilled himself for the camera's snap. Something in the set of his jaw says, posterity, as if he knows about the fact of me, that I, a person of his blood, will be here 80 years later, staring back at him. He looks relaxed, as if all real work in life has been done, and he's just in town on a sunny day with all the other old farmers to complain about wheat prices, shipping costs, and the lack of rain. His legs are set wide, his hands rest confidently on his thighs. Against the backdrop of his black trousers, his hands look massive, his fingers thick as sausages, his fists huge as ham hocks. Surely this is an optical illusion. Taken in context, his hands appear larger than his face or his thin neck. They look brutish, as if they have grasped for much in life, growing more enormous with each acquisition. These are the hands, I think, that got us out of Russia. What must it have been like for him, an immigrant, to come across this small ridge north of town on Highway 3 in the second half of his life and know that everything in sight belonged to him, had been shaped by his hand and the hands of children of his blood? Before he died at the age of 80, my great-grandfather distributed his wealth by setting off in severalty a parcel to each of his 9 children. His obituary in the Napoleon homestead reported, in appreciation of their cooperation. This description makes him sound kind of baronial, dispatching his land in parcels, as if ermine capes, rolls of parchment, and hot wax seals were involved. In the 1930s, my own grandfather, Joseph, the namesake and eldest son, took over the heart of the farm, the land with the lake, the orchard, the original farmstead, and these low-lying fields surrounding it. And in the 1950s, my father, Felix, who did not have the temperament to be a farmer, who had no aptitude with machinery, no affinity for livestock, who was impatient with nature and believed he could will it to deliver sun or rain if he just got angry enough or stared out the window at it long enough, took over this farm and the lifetime of hard work, worry, and frustration that went with it, just so the land would not go out of the family. In the end, my father fulfilled his generation's part of the agreement. On the morning of his funeral, I could look around and see the evidence. A mile ahead and to the right was the nest of white buildings on a gentle hill at the center of what was now my brother Nick's farm. It was early June. The land spread out flat for miles. The grass in the pastures was lush. The fields lay in rich black furrows. The seeds buried deep were just cracking their husks and letting go of tender green shoots. We were close to home now. If not for the small rise on the northern edge of town, I would have been able to see the grain elevators jutting into the sky and the thin spire of the Catholic Church bell tower, which would be ringing in moments for my father. The funeral would be at 10 o'clock, but the rosary vigil began at 9. It was now 9:15. I imagined my distraught mother at the funeral chapel, clutching a ragged Kleenex, her nose red from crying. She would be sitting in the front pew as mourners passed by to view my father stretched out in his coffin. My brother and his wife, all my sisters and their husbands, and all the grandchildren would have arrived by now. "But where is Debbie?" my mother would be wondering. "Has she been killed in a car accident?" My mother is a woman who believes in multi-part tragedies, in life unraveling in complex and ironic ways. And as her youngest daughter, I have given her much grist for her worry mill. If we had encountered this magnificent house on the road on any other stretch of Highway 3, we could have pulled out of the lane, hung in the ditch at a fierce angle, and stared in wonder for a few moments as it passed by, going north in the other lane. But on that day, we came upon the house precisely on the spot where county workers had decided that anonymous morning to repair a 40-foot stretch of the road. Workers in orange vests shoveled and packed down the soft tar. The right lane was cordoned off with a line of orange reflector cones. My husband pulled our van onto the gravel shoulder, and we joined a growing column of cars. Down the road, on the south side of the tarred lane, with the oncoming traffic, we could see the house on its springy flatbed bouncing and hulking like an over-anxious bull. This was not one of those sad double-wides with their vivisected halves roaring by you on the freeway and their backsides marked wide load. Often when I passed these trailer houses, their cross-sectioned walls battened down by a visqueen vapor barrier, I stretched to look inside, hoping to see an entire mobile home life going on, a man in a dingy wife-beater sprawled on a couch watching a grainy TV, a woman making cupcakes in the small island kitchen, a collection of Holly Hobby's collector plates rattling in their wire hangers on the thin dining room wall. But all I see is a hollow cavern of wind-blown emptiness. Not so this house on the road. Here was a sturdy two-story, complete with a wraparound three-season porch and an attic full of spooky gables. A house worth being torn off its 100-year-old foundation and rolling with logs and pulleys onto a monstrous flatbed. And on that day, it was making its 30-mile journey north to the town of Dawson, where it would become, I learned later, a lodge house for weekend hunters. But for now, it was solemn and dignified, moving at a queenly pace, as if rolling through a parade in its honor. In the distance, we could see the flatbed was flanked on all sides by the flashing red lights of police escorts and the nervous moving crew. Also shadowing the house, moving as it moved, were several Orange Power Company bucket trucks hoisting men in hard hats into the air. The men in the baskets were wearing rubber gloves and held long, slatted poles in their hands. As the house moved, the trucks moved, the men stretching the electrical wires over the matrix of eaves and chimneys with the poles. This was delicate work, dangerous. A small slip and more than one person could have died right before our eyes that morning. I looked at my watch. It was now 9:20. My husband didn't say anything, just got out of the car and approached one of the road workers. I watched them talk for a while on the side of the road, as only men can talk. The county worker spit a prodigious wad onto the blacktop. My husband lifted his shoulders and sank his hands deep into his pockets. My husband didn't look as if he belonged in this part of the country. He has a thick head of dark, wavy hair and soft, coffee-brown eyes. He has deep, slanted cheekbones and an arching Roman nose. Even in the more populated and slightly more diverse eastern part of the state, where his family lives, people would approach him in stores and say, "You're not from around here, are you?" If I had gotten out of the car and approached the county worker, the man would have said, "Oh, you're one of the Marquardt girls." So identifiable to the region are my family features. A narrowness of chin and angularity of eyes, that I'm sometimes called Little Felix by perfect strangers. But this is how small my hometown is. Even when my husband approached him, the county worker still said, "Oh, you're on your way to Felix's funeral." How did he know this? Why else would someone wearing dress slacks, who looks like he's not from around here, be on this road at this time of day, unless he were going to a funeral? I looked at my watch. It was 9:25. My husband turned in the wind and walked back to the van. I could tell by the look on his face the news was not good. 20 minutes, he said, getting in and slamming the car door. "They've got to move the house before we can pass." I looked around at the standing water in the ditches. There was almost enough dry room to pull the van off the blacktop, down the grassy incline, and make a quick getaway into town. But with all the cops around, I was not about to transform into Cousin Daisy from the Dukes of Hazzard and invite the pursuit of the drunken sheriff. This was how catastrophes happened, I knew from experience. One bad decision followed another. Had I done this on purpose? Gotten up a little later than I should have at the hotel, taken a little too long to get dressed before we checked out, so that I could arrive here at this moment? 3 miles down the road, my father was laid out in the Nickish funeral parlor, the spooky building we'd race by when we were kids, on our way from school, past the grain elevators and across the tracks to get to downtown. There was a death game we used to play. First, you'd cup your palm against someone else's palm. Then you'd run your thumb up and down the back of your own hand, while at the same time running your fingers along the back of the other person's hand. Then you'd scream and pull your hand away. It was eerie. You could feel the backside of your own hand with your thumb, but the other side, the part that was someone else's hand, was numb against the stroke of your fingers. "This is what death feels like," we'd whisper to each other in a creepy voice. It was as if the other half of your hand was nothing more than a numb shape in this world. It was busy, we theorized, doing advanced work in the other world, being a hand for you across that unknown threshold to which your now half-a-feeling hand would eventually be pulled. I thought of my father's body dressed in a blue suit, lying parallel to the horizon inside a steel-blue coffin lined with satin. And that's where we must leave our reading today of The Horizontal World by Deborah Marquardt, who is an English professor and the coordinator of the Creative Writing Program at Iowa State University in Ames. You've been listening to the Community Bookshelf, which you can hear every Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday at 8 p.m. The producer is Mary Richards, that's me, co-producer Janet Kloss, and program engineer Ron Latson. We appreciate feedback at 515-292-2878 or khoiradio@gmail.com. Thank you very much for listening.